When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at Remarkable.com today.
Chapter 1 of The Defiant Agents by Andre Norton. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, visit LibriVox.org. The Defiant Agents. Chapter 1. No windows broke any of the four plain walls of the office. There was no focus of outer world sunlight on the desk there. Yet the five disks set out on its surface appeared to glow. Perhaps the heat of the mischief they could cause, had caused, blazed in them. But fanciful imaginings did not cushion or veil cold, hard fact. Dr. Gordon Ashe, one of the four men peering unhappily at the display, shook his head slightly, as if to free his mind of such cobwebs. His neighbor to the right, Colonel Calgaris, leaned forward to ask harshly, "No chance of a mistake?" "You saw the detector." The thin gray string of a man behind the desk answered with chill precision. "No, no possible mistake. These five have definitely been snooped." "And two choices among them," Ashe murmured. That was the important point now. "I thought these were under maximum security," Calgaris challenged the gray man. Florian Waldauer's remote expression did not change. "Every possible precaution was in force. There was a sleeper, a hidden agent, planted." "Who?" Calgaris demanded. Ashe glanced around at his three companions. Calgaris, colonel in command of one sector of Project Star, Florian Waldauer, the security man on the station, Dr. James Ruthven. "Camden," he said, hardly able to believe this answer to which logic had led him. Waldauer nodded. For the first time since he had known and worked with Calgaris, Ashe saw him display open astonishment. "Camden? But he was sent us by—" The colonel's eyes narrowed. "He must have been sent—" "There were too many cross-checks to fake that." "Oh, he was sent, all right." For the first time there was a note of emotion in Waldauer's voice. "He was a sleeper, a very deep sleeper. They must have planted him a full 25 or 30 years ago. He's been just what he claimed to be as long as that." "Well, he certainly was worth their time and trouble, wasn't he?" James Ruthven's voice was a growling rumble. He sucked in thick lips, continuing to stare at the disks. "How long ago were these snooped?" Ashe's thoughts turned swiftly from the enormity of the betrayal to that important point. The time element. That was the primary concern now that the damage was done, and they knew it. "That's one thing we don't know." Waldauer's reply came slowly, as if he hated the admission. "We'll be safer, then, if we presume the very earliest period." Ruthven's statement was as ruthless in its implications as the shock they had had when Waldauer announced the disaster. 18 months ago?" Ashe protested. But Ruthven was nodding. "Camden was in on this from the very first. We've had the tapes in and out for study all that time. And the new detector against snooping was not put in service until 2 weeks ago. This case came up on the first checking round, didn't it?" he asked Waldauer. "First check," the security man agreed. "Camden left the base 6 days ago. But he has been in and out on his liaison duties from the first." He had to go through those search points every time, Calgary's protested. Thought nothing could get through those. The colonel brightened. Maybe he got his snooper films and then couldn't take them off the base. Have his quarters been turned out? Waldar's lips lifted in a grimace of exasperation. Please, Colonel, he said wearily, this is not a kindergarten exercise. In confirmation of his success, listen. He touched a button on his desk, and out of the air came the emotionless chant of a newscaster. Fears for the safety of Lassiter Camden, space expediter for the West Conference Space Council, have been confirmed by the discovery of burned wreckage in the mountains. Mr. Camden was returning from a mission to the Star Laboratory when his plane lost contact with Ragnar Field. Reports of a storm in that vicinity immediately raised concern. Waldauer snapped off the voice. True, or a cover for his escape? Calgary's wondered aloud. Could be either. They may have deliberately written him off when they had all they wanted, Waldauer acknowledged. But to get back to our troubles, Dr. Ruthven is right to assume the worst. I believe we can only ensure the recovery of our project by thinking that these tapes were snooped anywhere from 18 months ago to last week. And we must work accordingly. There was silence in the room as they all considered that. Ash slipped down in his chair, his thoughts enmeshed in memories. First, there had been Operation Retrograde, when specially trained time agents had shuttled back and forth in history, striving to locate and track down the mysterious source of alien knowledge which the Eastern Communistic nations had suddenly begun to use. Ash himself and a younger partner, Ross Murdoch, had been part of the final action which had solved the mystery, having traced that source of knowledge not to an earlier and forgotten Terran civilization, but to wrecked spaceships from an eon-old galactic empire, an empire which had flourished when glacial ice covered most of Europe and Northern America, and Terrans were cave-dwelling primitives. Murdoch, trapped by the Reds in one of those wrecked ships, had inadvertently summoned its original owners, who had descended to trace, through the Russian time stations, the looters of their wrecks, destroying the whole Red time travel system. But the aliens had not chanced on the parallel Western system, and a year later they had been put into Project Folsom I. Again, Ash, Murdoch, and a newcomer, the Apache Travis Fox, had gone back into time to the Arizona of the Folsom Hunters, discovering what they wanted. Two ships, one wrecked, the other intact. And when the full efforts of the project had been centered on bringing the intact ship back into the present, chance had triggered controls set by the dead alien commander. A party of four, Ash, Murdoch, Fox, and a technician, had then made an involuntary voyage into space, touching three worlds on which the galactic civilization of the far past was now marked only by ruins. Voyage tape, fed into the controls of the ship, had taken the men, and when rewound had, by a miracle, returned them to Terra with a cargo of similar tapes found in a building on a world which might have been the central capital for a government comprised not of countries or of worlds, but of solar systems. Tapes, each one the key to another planet. And that ancient galactic knowledge was treasure such as the Terrans had never dreamed of possessing, though there were the attendant fears that such discoveries could be weapons in enemy hands. There had been an enforced sharing with other nations of tapes chosen at random at a great drawing. And each nation secretly remained convinced that, in spite of the untold riches it might hold as a result of chance, its rivals had done better. Right at this moment, Ash did not in the least doubt there were agents of his own party intent on accomplishing at the Red Project just what Camden had done there. However, that did not help in solving their present dilemma concerning Operation Cochise, one part of their project, but perhaps the most important now. Some of the tapes were duds, either too damaged to be useful or set for worlds hostile to Terrans lacking the equipment the earlier star-traveling race had had at its command. Of the five tapes they now knew had been snooped, three would be useless to the enemy. But one of the remaining two, Ash frowned. One was the goal toward which they had been working feverishly for a full 12 months. To plant a colony across the gulf of space, a successful colony, later to be used as a stepping stone to other worlds. "So we have to move faster." Ruthven's comment reached Ash through his stream of memories.
"I thought you required at least 3 more months to conclude personnel training," Waldauer observed.
Ruthven lifted a fat hand, running the nail of a broad thumb back and forth across his lower lip in a habitual gesture Ash had learned to mistrust. As the latter stiffened, bracing for a battle of wills, he saw Calgary's come alert too. At least the colonel more often than not was ready to counter Ruthven's demands.
"We test and we test," said the fat man. "Always we test. We move like turtles when it would be better to race like greyhounds. There is such a thing as overcaution, as I have said from the first. One would think," his accusing glance included Ash and Calgary's, "that there had never been any improvising in this project, that all had always been done by the book. I say that this is the time we must take the big gamble, or else we may find we have been outbid for space entirely. Let those others discover even one alien installation they can master, and—" his thumb shifted from his lip, grinding down on the desktop as if it were crushing some venturesome but entirely unimportant insect— "and we are finished before we really begin." There were a number of men in the project who would agree with that, Ash knew, and a greater number in the country and conference at large. The public was used to reckless gambles which paid off, and there had been enough of those in the past to give an impressive argument for that point of view. But Ash himself could not agree to a speed-up. He had been out among the stars, shaved disaster too closely because the proper training had not been given. "I shall report that I advise a take-off within a week," Ruthven was continuing. "To the Council I shall say that—"
"And I do not agree," Ash cut in.
He glanced at Calgary's for the quick backing he expected, but instead there was a lengthening moment of silence. Then the colonel spread out his hands and said sullenly,
"I don't agree either, but I don't have the final say-so. Ash, what would be needed to speed up any take-off?"
It was Ruthven who replied,
"We can use the redax, as I have said from the start."
Ash straightened, his mouth tight, his eyes hard and angry.
"And I'll protest that, to the Council. Man, we're dealing with human beings, selected volunteers, men who trust us. Not with laboratory animals."
Ruthven's thick lips pouted into what was close to a smile of derision.
"Always the sentimentalists, you experts in the past. Tell me, Dr. Ash, were you always so thoughtful of your men when you sent agents back into time? And certainly a voyage into space is less a risk than time travel. These volunteers know what they have signed for. They will be ready."
"Then you propose telling them about the use of redax, what it does to a man's mind?" countered Ash.
"Certainly. They will receive all necessary instructions."
Ash was not satisfied, and he would have spoken again, but Calgary's interrupted.
"If it comes to that, none of us here has any right to make final decisions. Waldauer has already sent in his report about the snoop. We'll have to await orders from the Council."
Ruthven levered himself out of his chair, his solid bulk stretching his uniform coveralls.
"That is correct, Colonel. In the meantime, I would suggest we all check to see what can be done to speed up each one's portion of labor."
Without another word, he tramped to the door. Waldauer eyed the other two with mounting impatience. It was plain he had work to do and wanted them to leave. But Ash was reluctant. He had a feeling that matters were slipping out of his control, that he was about to face a crisis
which was somehow worse than just a major security leak. Was the enemy always on the other side of the world? Or could he wear the same uniform, even share the same goals? In the outer corridor he still hesitated, and Calgary's, a step or so in advance, looked back over his shoulder impatiently.
"There's no use in fighting. Our hands are tied."
His words were slurred, almost as if he wanted to disown them.
"Then you'll agree to use the redax?"
For the second time within the hour, Ash felt as if he had taken a step only to have firm earth turn into slippery, shifting sand underfoot.
"It isn't a matter of my agreeing. It may be a matter of getting through or not getting through now. If they've had 18 months, or even 12,
the colonel's fingers balled into a fist,
"and they won't be delayed by any humanitarian reasoning."
"Then you believe Ruthven will win the Council's approval?"
"When you are dealing with frightened men, you're talking to ears closed to anything but what they want to hear. After all, we can't prove that the redax will be harmful."
"But we've only used it under rigidly controlled conditions. To speed up the process would mean a total disregard of those controls. Snapping a party of men and women back into their racial past and holding them there for too long a period—"
Ash shook his head.
"You have been in Operation Retrograde from the start, and we've been remarkably successful. Operating in a different way, educating picked men to return to certain points in history where their particular temperaments and characteristics fitted the roles they were selected to play, yes, and even then we had our percentage of failures. But to try this, returning people not physically into time, but mentally and emotionally into prototypes of their ancestors, that's something else again. The Apaches have volunteered, and they've been passed by the psychologists and the testers. But they're Americans of today, not tribal nomads of 200 or 300 years ago. If you break down some barriers, you might just end up breaking them all."
Calgary's was scowling.
"You mean they might revert utterly, have no contact with the present at all?"
"That's just what I do mean. Education and training, yes. But full awakening of racial memories? No. The two branches of conditioning should go slowly and hand in hand. Otherwise, real trouble."
"Only we no longer have the time to go slow. I'm certain Ruthven will be able to push this through, with Waldauer's report to back him."
"Then we'll have to warn Fox and the rest. They must be given a choice in the matter."
"Ruthven said that would be done."
The colonel did not sound convinced of that.
Ash snorted. "If I hear him telling them, I'll believe it."
"I wonder whether we can—"
Ash half turned and frowned at the colonel.
"What do you mean?"
"You said yourself that we had failures in time travel. We expected those, accepted them, even when they hurt. When we asked for volunteers for this project, we had to make them understand that there was a heavy element of risk involved. Three teams of recruits, the Eskimos from Point Barren, the Apaches, and the Islanders, all picked because their people had a high survival rating in the past to be colonists on widely different types of planets. Well, the Eskimos and the Islanders aren't matched to any of the worlds on those Snoop tapes. But Topaz is waiting for the Apaches. And we may have to move them in there in a hurry. It's a rotten gamble any way you see it."
"I'll appeal directly to the Council."
Calgary shrugged.
"All right, you have my backing."
"But you believe such an effort hopeless?"
"You know the red tape merchants. You'll have to move fast if you want to beat Ruthven. He's probably on a straight line now to Stanton, Reese, and Margate. This is what he has been waiting for."
"There are the news syndicates. Public opinion would back us."
"You don't mean that, of course."
Calgary's was suddenly coldly remote. Ash flushed under the heavy brown which overlay his regular features. To threaten a silence break was near blasphemy here.
He ran both hands down the fabric covering his thighs as if to rub away some soil on his palms.
"No," he replied heavily, his voice dull. "I guess I don't. I'll contact Huff and hope for the best."
"Meanwhile," Calgary spoke briskly, "we'll do what we can to speed up the program as it now stands. I suggest you take off for New York within the hour."
"Me? Why?"
Ash asked with a trace of suspicion.
"Because I can't leave without acting directly against orders, and that would put us wrong immediately. You see Huff and talk to him personally. Put it to him straight. He'll have to have all the facts if he's going to counter any move from Stanton before the Council. You know every argument we can use and all the proof on our side, and you're authority enough to make it count."
"If I can do all that, I will." Ash was alert and eager. The Colonel, seeing his change of expression, felt easier. But Calgary stood a moment watching Ash as he hurried down a side corridor, before he moved on slowly to his own box of an office. Once inside, he sat for a long, unhappy time, staring at the wall and seeing nothing but the pictures produced by his thoughts. Then he pressed a button and read off the symbols which flashed on a small visiscreen set in his desk. Another button pushed, and he picked up a hand mic to relay an order which might postpone trouble for a while. Ash was far too valuable a man to lose, and his emotions could boil him straight into disaster over this.
"Bidwell, reschedule Team A. They are to go to the hypno-lab instead of the reserve in 10 minutes."
Releasing the mic, he again stared at the wall. No one dared interrupt a hypno-training period, and this one would last 3 hours. Ash could not possibly see the trainees before he left for New York. And that would remove one temptation from his path. He would not talk at the wrong time. Calgary's mouth twisted sourly. He had no pride in what he was doing. And he was perfectly certain that Ruthven would win and that Ash's fears of Redax were well-founded. It all came back to the old basic tenet of the service. The end justified the means. They must use every method and man under their control to make sure that Topaz would remain a Western possession, even though that strange planet, now swung far beyond the sky which covered both the Western and Eastern alliances on Terra. Time had run out too fast. They were being forced to play what cards they held, even though those might be very low ones. Ash would be back, but not, Calgary's hoped, until this had been decided one way or another. Not until this was finished. Finished. Calgary's blinked at the wall. Perhaps they were finished, too. No one would know until the transport ship landed on that other world which appeared on the direction tape symbolized by a jewel-like disk of gold-brown which had given it the code name of Topaz. End of Chapter 1. Chapter 2. Of the Defiant Agents by Andre Norton. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Defiant Agents. Chapter 2. There were an even dozen of the airborne guardians, each following the swing of its own orbital path just within the atmospheric envelope of the planet which glowed as a great bronze-golden gem in the four-world system of a yellow star. The globes had been launched to form a web of protection around Topaz 6 months earlier, and the highest skill had gone into their production. Just as contact mines sown in a harbor could close that landfall to ships, not knowing the secret channel, so was this world supposedly closed to any spaceship not equipped with a signal to ward off the sphere missiles. That was the theory of the new off-world settlers whose protection they were to be, already tested as well as possible, but as yet not put to the ultimate proof. The small bright globes spun undisturbed across a two-moon sky at night and made reassuring blips on an installation screen by day. Then a 13th object winked into being, began the encircling, closing spiral of descent. A sphere resembling the Warden globes, it was 100 times their size, and its orbit was purposefully controlled by instruments under the eye and hand of a human pilot. Four men were strapped down on cushioned sling seats in the control cabin of the Western Alliance ship, two hanging where their fingers might reach buttons and levers, and others merely passengers, their own labor waiting for the time when they would set down on the alien soil of Topaz. The planet hung there in their visiscreen, richly beautiful in its amber gold, growing larger, nearer, so that they could pick out features of seas, continents, mountain ranges, which had been studied on tape until they were familiar, yet now were strangely unfamiliar too. One of the Warden globes alerted, oscillated in its set path, whirled faster as its delicate interior mechanisms responded to the awakening spark which would send it on its mission of destruction. A relay clicked, but for the smallest fraction of a millimeter failed to set the proper course. On the instrument, far below, which checked the globe's new course, the mistake was not noted. The screen of the ship spiraling toward Topaz registered a path which would bring it into violent contact with the globe. They were still some hundreds of miles apart when the alarm rang. The pilot's hand clawed out at the bank of controls. Under the almost intolerable pressure of their descent, there was so little he could do. His crooked fingers fell back powerlessly from the buttons and levers. His mouth was a twisted grimace of bleak acceptance as the beat of the signal increased. One of the passengers forced his head around on the padded rest, fought to form words, to speak to his companion. The other was staring ahead at the screen, his thick lips wide and flat against his teeth in a snarl of rage.
"They are here."
Ruthven paid no attention to the obvious, as stated by his fellow scientist. His fury was a red, pulsing thing inside him, fed by his own helplessness. To be pinned here so near his goal, fastened up as a target for an inanimate but cunningly fashioned weapon, ate into him like a stream of deadly acid. His big gamble would puff out in a blast of fire to light up Topaz's sky, with nothing left, nothing. On the armrest of his sling seat, his nails scratched deep. The four men in the control cabin could only sit and watch, waiting for the rendezvous which would blot them out. Ruthven's flaming anger was a futile blaze. His companion in the passenger seat had closed his eyes, his lips moving soundlessly in an expression of his own scattered thoughts. The pilot and his assistant divided their attention between the screen, with its appalling message, and the controls they could not effectively use, feverishly seeking a way out in these last moments. Below them, in the bowl of the ship, were those who would not know the end consciously, save in one compartment. In a padded cage, a prick-eared head stirred where it rested on forepaws, slitted eyes blinked, aware not only of familiar surroundings, but also of the tension and fear generated by human minds and emotions levels above. A pointed nose raised, and there was a growling deep in a throat covered with thick, buff-gray hair. The growl aroused another similar captive. Knowing yellow eyes met yellow eyes. An intelligence, which was certainly not that of the animal body which contained it, fought down instinct raging to send both those bodies hurtling at the fastenings of the twin cages. Curiosity and the ability to adapt had been bred into both from time immemorial. Then something else had been added to sly and cunning brains. A step up had been taken, to weld intelligence to cunning, connect thought to instinct. More than a generation earlier, mankind had chosen barren desert, the white sands of New Mexico, as a testing ground for atomic experiments. Humankind could be barred, warded out of the radiation limits. The natural desert dwellers, four-footed and winged, could not be so controlled. For thousands of years, since the first southward roving Amerindian tribes had met with their kind, there had been a hunter of the open country, a smaller cousin of the wolf, whose natural abilities had made an undeniable impression on the human mind. He was in countless Indian legends as the shaper or the trickster, sometimes friend, sometimes enemy. Godling for some tribes, father of all evil for others. In the wealth of tales, the coyote, above all other animals, had a firm place. Driven by the press of civilization into the badlands and deserts, fought with poison, gun, and trap, the coyote had survived, adapting to new ways with all his legendary cunning. Those who had reviled him as vermin had unwillingly added to the folklore which surrounded him, telling their own tales of robbed traps, skillful escapes. He continued to be a trickster, laughing on moonlit nights from the tops of ridges at those who would hunt him down. Then, close to the end of the 20th century, when myths were scoffed at, the stories of the coyote slyness began once more on a fantastic scale. And finally, scientists were sufficiently intrigued to seek out this creature that seemed to display in truth all the abilities credited to his immortal namesake by pre-Columbian tribes. What they discovered was indeed shattering to certain closed minds. For the coyote had not only adapted to the country of the White Sands, he had evolved into something which could not be dismissed as an animal, clever and cunning, but limited to beast range. Six cubs had been brought back on the first expedition. Coyote in body, their developing minds different. The grandchildren of those cubs were now in the ship's cages, their mutated senses alert, ready for the slightest chance of escape. Sent to Topaz as eyes and ears for less keenly endowed humans, they were not completely under the domination of man. The range of their mental powers was still uncomprehended by those who had bred, trained, and worked with them from the days their eyes had opened and they had taken their first wobbly steps away from their dams. The male growled again, his lips wrinkling back in a snarl as the emanations of fear from the men he could not see reached panic peak. He still crouched, belly flat, on the protecting pads of his cage, but he strove now to wriggle closer to the door, just as his mate made the same effort. Between the animals and those in the control cabin lay the others, 40 of them. Their bodies were cushioned and protected with every ingenious device known to those who had placed them there so many weeks earlier. Their minds were free of the ship, roving into places where men had not trod before, a territory potentially more dangerous than any solid Earth could ever be. Operation Retrograde had returned men bodily into the past, sending agents to hunt mammoths, follow the roads of the Bronze Age traders, ride with Attila and Genghis Khan, pull bows among the archers of ancient Egypt. But Redax returned men in mind to the paths of their ancestors, or this was the theory. And those who slept here and now in their narrow boxes lay under its government, while the men who had arbitrarily set them so could only assume they were actually reliving the lives of Apache nomads in the wide southwestern wastes of the late 18th and early 19th centuries. Above, the pilot's hand pushed out again, fighting the pressure to reach one particular button. That, too, had been a last-minute addition, an experiment which had only had partial testing. To use it was the final move he could make, and he was already half convinced of its uselessness. With no faith and only very wan hope, he set that round of metal flush with the board. What followed no one ever lived to explain. On the planet, the installation which tracked the missiles flashed on a screen bright enough to blind momentarily the duty man on watch, and its tracker was shaken off course. When it jiggled back into line, it was no longer the efficient eye in the sky it had been, though its tenders were not to realize that for an important minute or two. While the ship, now out of control, sped in dizzy whirls toward Topaz, engines fought blindly to stabilize, to re-establish their functions. Some succeeded, some wobbled in and out of the danger zone, two failed. and in the control cabin three dead men spun in prisoning seats. Dr. James Ruthven, blood bubbling from his lips with every shallow breath he could draw, fought the stealthy tide of blackness which crept up his brain, his stubborn will holding to rags of consciousness, refusing to acknowledge the pain of his fatally injured body. The orbiting ship was on an erratic path. Slowly the machines were correcting, relays clicking, striving to bring it to a landing under autopilot. All the ingenuity built into a mechanical brain was now centered in landing the globe. It was not a good landing, in fact, a very bad one, for the sphere touched a mountainside, scraped down rocks, shearing away a portion of its outer bulk. But the mountain barrier was now between it and the base from which the missiles had been launched, and the crash had not been recorded on that tracking instrument. So far as the watchers several hundred miles away knew, the warden in the sky had performed as promised. Their first line of defense had proven satisfactory, and there had been no unauthorized landing on Topaz. In the wreckage of the control cabin, Ruthven pawed at the fastenings of his sling chair. He no longer tried to suppress the moans every effort tore out of him. Time held the whip, drove him. He rolled from his seat to the floor, lay there gasping, as again he fought doggedly to remain above the waves, those frightening, fast-coming waves of dark faintness. Somehow he was crawling, crawling along a tilted surface until he gained the well where the ladder to the lower section hung, now at an acute angle. It was that angle which helped him to the next level. He was too dazed to realize the meaning of the crumpled bulkheads. There was a spur of bare rock under his hands as he edged over and around twisted metal. The moans were now a gobbling, burbling, almost continuous cry as he reached his goal, a small cabin still intact. For long moments of anguish he paused by the chair there, afraid that he could not make the last effort, raise his almost inert bulk up to the point where he could reach the redax release. For a second of unusual clarity he wondered if there was any reason for this supreme ordeal, whether any of the sleepers could be aroused. This might now be a ship of the dead. His right hand, his arm, and finally his bulk over the seat, he braced himself and brought his left hand up. He could not use any of the fingers. It was like lifting a numb, heavy weight. But he lurched forward, swept the unfeeling lump of cold flesh down against the release in a gesture which he knew must be his final move. And as he fell back to the floor, Dr. Ruthven could not be certain whether he had succeeded or failed. He tried to screw his head around to focus his eyes upward at that switch. Was it down or still stubbornly up, locking the sleepers into confinement? But there was a fog between. He could not see it or anything. The light in the cabin flickered, was gone as another circuit in the broken ship failed. It was dark, too, in the small cubby below which housed the two cages. Chance, which had snuffed out 19 lives in the space globe, had missed ripping open that cabin on the mountainside. 5 yards down the corridor the outside fabric of the ship was split wide open, the crisp air native to Topaz entering, sending a message to two keen noses through the combination of odors now pervading the wreckage. And the male coyote went into action. Days ago he had managed to work loose the lower end of the mesh which fronted his cage, but his mind had told him that a sortie inside the ship was valueless. The odd rapport he'd had with the human brains, unknown to them, had operated to keep him to the old role of cunning deception, which in the past had saved countless of his species from sudden and violent death. Now, with teeth and paws, he went diligently to work, urged on by the whines of his mate, that tantalizing smell of an outside world tickling their nostrils, a wild world lacking the taint of man-places. He slipped under the loosened mesh and stood up to paw at the front of the female's cage. One forepaw caught in the latch and pressed it down, and the weight of the door swung against him. Together they were free now to reach the corridor, and see ahead the subdued light of a strange moon beckoning them on into the open. The female, always more cautious than her mate, lingered behind as he trotted forward, his ears a prick with curiosity. Their training had been the same since cubhood, to range and explore, but always in the company and at the order of man. This was not according to the pattern she knew, and she was suspicious. But to her sensitive nose the smell of the ship was an offense, and the puffs of breeze from without enticing. Her mate had already slipped through the break. Now he barked with excitement and wonder, and she trotted on to join him. Above, the redax, which had never been intended to stand rough usage, proved to be a better survivor of the crash than most of the other installations. Power purred along a network of lines, activated beams, turned off and on a series of fixtures on those coffin beds. For five of the sleepers, nothing. The cabin which had held them was a flattened smear against the mountainside. Three more half-aroused, choked, fought for life and breath in a darkness which was a mercifully short nightmare, and succumbed. But in the cabin nearest the rent through which the coyotes had escaped, a young man sat up abruptly, looking into the dark with wide-open, terror-haunted eyes. He clawed for purchase against the smooth edge of the box in which he had lain, somehow got to his knees, weaving weakly back and forth, and half fell, half pushed to the floor, where he could stand only by keeping his hold on the box. Dazed, sick, weak, he swayed there, aware only of himself and his own sensations. There were small sounds in the dark, a stilled moan, a gasping sigh. But that meant nothing. Within him grew a compulsion to be out of this place, his terror making him lurch forward. His flailing hand rapped painfully against an upright surface, which his questing fingers identified hazily as an exit. Unconsciously, he fumbled along the surface of the door until it gave under that weak pressure. Then he was out, his head swimming, drawn by the light behind the wall rent. He progressed toward that in a scrambling crawl, making his way over the splintered skin of the globe. Then he dropped with a jarring thud onto the mound of earth the ship had pushed before it during its downward slide. Limply, he tumbled on in a small cascade of clods and sand, hitting against a less movable rock with force enough to roll him over on his back and stun him again. The second and smaller moon of Topaz swung brightly through the sky, its weird green rays making the blood-streaked face of the explorer an alien mask. It had passed well on to the horizon, and its large yellow companion had risen when a yapping broke the small sounds of the night. As the yip-yip-yip arose in a crescendo, the man stirred, putting one hand to his head. His eyes opened, he looked vaguely about him and sat up. Behind him was the torn and ripped ship, but he did not look back at it. Instead, he got to his feet and staggered out into the direct path of the moonlight. Inside his brain there was a whirl of thoughts, memories, emotions. Perhaps Ruthven or one of his assistants could have explained that chaotic mixture for what it was. But for all practical purposes, Travis Fox, Amerindian time agent, member of Team A, Operation Cochise, was far less of a thinking animal now than the two coyotes paying their ritual addresses to a moon which was not the one of their vanished homeland. Travis wavered on, drawn somehow by that howling. It was familiar, a thread of something real through all the broken clutter in his head. He stumbled, fell, crawled up again, but he kept on. Above, the female coyote lowered her head, drew a test sniff of a new scent. She recognized that as part of the proper way of life. She yapped once at her mate, but he was absorbed in his night song, his muzzle pointed moonward as he voiced a fine wailing. Travis tripped, pitched forward on his hands and knees, and felt the jar of such a landing shoot up his stiffened forearms. He tried to get up, but his body only twisted, so he landed on his back and lay looking up at the moon. A strong, familiar odor. Then a shadow looming above him. Hot breath against his cheek, and the swift sweep of an animal tongue on his face. He flung up his hand, gripped thick fur, and held on, as if he had found one anchor of sanity in a world gone completely mad. End of chapter 2. Chapter 3 of The Defiant Agents by Andre Norton. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Defiant Agents. Chapter 3. Travis, one knee braced against the red earth, blinked as he parted a screen of tall rust-brown grass with cautious fingers to look out into a valley where golden mist clouded most of the landscape. His head ached with dull persistence, the pain fostered in some way by his own bewilderment. To study the land ahead was like trying to see through one picture interposed over another and a far different one. He knew what ought to be there, but what was before him was very dissimilar. A buff gray shape flitted through the tall cover grass, and Travis tensed. M'ba'a? Coyote? Or were these companions of his actually gotten spirits who could choose their shape at will, and had, oddly, this time assumed the bodies of man's tricky enemy? Were they Ndendai, enemies, or Dalanbiat'i, allies? In this mad world he did not know. Iyadike? His mind formed a word he did not speak. Friend? Yellow eyes met his directly. Dimly he had been aware, ever since awaking in this strange wilderness with the coming of morning light, that the four-footed ones trotting with him as he walked aimlessly had unbeast-like traits. Not only did they face him eye to eye, but in some ways they appeared able to read his thoughts. He had longed for water to ease the burning in his throat, the ever-present pain in his head, and the creatures had nudged him in another direction, bringing him to a pool where he had mouthed liquid with a strange, sweet, but not unpleasant taste. Now he had given them names, names which had come out of the welter of dreams which shadowed his stumbling journey across this weird country. Nalik-Ideyu, maiden who walks ridges, was the female who continued to shepherd him along, never venturing too far from his side. Nagin-Ulta, he who scouts ahead, was the male who did just that, disappearing at long intervals and then returning to face the man and his mate, as if conveying some report necessary to their journey. It was Nalik-Ideyu who sought out Travis now, her red tongue lolling from her mouth as she panted. Not from exertion, he was certain of that. No, she was excited and eager. On the hunt. That was it. A hunt. Travis' own tongue ran across his lips as an impression hit him with feral force. There was meat, rich, fresh, just ahead. Meat that lived, waiting to be killed. Inside him his own avid hunger roused, shaking him farther out of the crusting dream. His hands went to his waist, but the groping fingers did not find what vague memory told him should be there, a belt heavy with knife in sheath. He examined his own body with attention to find that he was adequately covered by breeches of a smooth, dull brown material which blended well with the vegetation about him. He wore a loose shirt, belted in at the narrow waist by a folded strip of cloth, the ends of which fluttered free. On his feet were tall moccasins, the leg pieces extending some distance up his calves, the toes turned up in rounded points. Some of this he found familiar, but these were fragments of memory. Again his mind fitted one picture above another. One thing he did know for sure, he had no weapons, and that realization struck home with a thrust of real and terrible fear which tore away more of the bewilderment cloaking his mind. Nalik-Ideyu was impatient. Having advanced a step or two, she now looked back at him over her shoulder, yellow eyes slitted, her demand on him as instant and real as if she had voiced understandable words. Meat was waiting, and she was hungry. Also, she expected Travis to aid in the hunt at once. Though he could not match her fluid grace in moving through the grass, Travis followed her, keeping to cover. He shook his head vigorously in spite of the stab of pain the motion caused him, and paid more attention to his surroundings. It was apparent that the earth under him, the grass around, the valley of the golden haze, were all real, not part of a dream. Therefore, that other countryside, which he kept seeing in a ghostly fashion, was a hallucination. Even the air which he drew into his lungs and expelled again had a strange smell, or was it taste? He could not be sure which. He knew that hypno-training could produce queer side effects, but this... Travis paused, staring unseeingly before him at the grass still waving from the coyote's passage. Hypno-training. What was that? Now three pictures fought to focus in his mind. The two landscapes which did not match, and a shadowy third. He shook his head again, his hands to his temples. This only was real. The ground, the grass, the valley, the hunger in him, the hunt waiting. He forced himself to concentrate on the immediate present and the portion of world he could see, feel, scent, which lay here and now about him. The grass grew shorter as he proceeded in Nalak Ideyu's wake. But the haze was not thinning. It seemed to hang in patches, and when he ventured through the edge of a patch, it was like creeping through a fog of golden, dancing motes, with here and there a glittering speck whirling and darting like a living thing. Masked by the stuff, Travis reached a line of brush and sniffed. It was a warm scent, a heavy odor he could not identify, and yet one he associated with a living creature. Flat to earth, he pushed his head and shoulders under the low limbs of the bush to look ahead. Here was a space where the fog did not hold, a pocket of earth clear under the morning sun. And grazing there were three animals. Again, shock cleared a portion of Travis' bemused brain. They were about the size, he thought, of antelopes, and they had a general resemblance to those beasts in that they had four slender legs, a rounded body, and a head. But they had alien features, so alien as to hold him in open-mouthed amazement. The bodies had bare spots here and there, and patches of creamy fur. Or was it hair which hung in strips, as if the creatures had been partially plucked in a careless fashion? The necks were long and moved about in a serpentine motion, as though their spines were as limber as reptiles. On the other end of those long and twisting necks were heads which also appeared more suitable to another species, broad, rather flat, with a singular toad-like look, but furnished with horns set halfway down the nose, horns which began in a single root and then branched into two sharp points. They were unearthly. Again Travis blinked, brought his hand up to his head as he continued to view the browsers. There were three of them, two larger and with horns, the other a smaller beast, with less of the ragged fur and only the beginning button of a protuberance on the nose. It was probably a calf. One of those mental alerts from the coyotes broke his absorption. Nalak Ideyu was not interested in the odd appearance of the grazing creatures. She was intent upon their usefulness in another way, as a full and satisfying meal, and she was again impatient with him for his dull response. His examination took a more practical turn. An antelope's defense was speed, though it could be tricked into hunting range through its inordinate curiosity. The slender legs of these beasts suggested a like degree of speed, and Travis had no weapons at all. Those nose horns had an ugly look. This thing might be a fighter rather than a runner. But the suggestion which had flashed from coyote to him had taken root. Travis was hungry. He was a hunter, and here was meat on the hoof, queer as it looked. Again he received a message. Nagan Ulta was on the opposite side of the clearing. If the creatures depended on speed, then Travis believed they could probably outrun not only him but the coyotes as well, which left cunning and some sort of plan. Travis glanced at the cover where he knew Nalik Ideyu crouched, and from which had come that flash of agreement. He shivered. These were truly no animals, but Ga'n, Ga'n of power. And as Ga'n, he must treat them, accede to their will. Spurred by that, the Apache gave only flicks of attention to the browsers, while at the same time he studied the part of the landscape uncovered by mist. Without weapons or speed, they must conceive a trap. Again Travis sensed that agreement which was Ga'n magic, and with it the strong impression urging him to the right. He was making progress with skill he did not even recognize, and which he had never been conscious of learning. The bushes and small droop-limbed trees, their branches not clothed with leaves from proper twigs, but with a reddish bristly growth protruding directly from their surfaces, made a partial wall for the pocket-sized meadow. That screen reached a rocky cleft, where the mist curled in a long tongue through a wall twice Travis' height. If the browsers could be maneuvered into taking the path through that cleft. Travis searched about him, and his hands closed upon the oldest weapon of his species, a stone pulled from an earth pocket and balanced neatly in the palm of his hand. It was a long chance, but his best one. The Apache took the first step on a new and fearsome road. These Ga'n had put their thoughts, or their desires, into his mind. Could he so contact them in return? With the stone clenched in his fist, his shoulders back against the wall not too far from the cleft opening, Travis strove to think out, clearly and simply, this poor plan of his. He did not know that he was reacting the way scientists deep space away had hoped he might. Nor did Travis guess that at this point he had already traveled far beyond the expectations of the men who had bred and trained the two mutant coyotes. He only believed that this might be the one way he could obey the wishes of the two spirits he thought far more powerful than any man. So he pictured in his mind the cleft, the running creatures, and the part the Ga'n could play if they so willed. Ascent. In its way, as loud and clear as if shouted. The man fingered the stone, weighed it. There would probably be just one moment when he could use it to effect, and he must be ready. From this point, he could no longer see the small meadow where the grazers were, but Travis knew, as well as if he watched the scene, that the coyotes were creeping in, belly flat to earth, adding a feline stealth and patience to their own cunning. There. Travis' head jerked, the alert had come, the drive was beginning. He tensed, gripping his stone. A yapping bark was answered by a sound he could not describe, a noise which was neither cough nor grunt, but a combination of both. Again, yap, yap. A toadhead burst through the screen of brush, the double horn on its nose festooned with a length of grass torn up by the roots. Wide eyes, milky and seeming to be without pupils, fastened on Travis. But he could not be sure the thing saw him, for it kept on, picking up speed as it approached the cleft. Behind it ran the calf, and that guttural cry was bubbling from its broad, flat lips. The long neck of the adult writhed, the frog head swung closer to the ground so that the twin points of the horn were at a slant, aimed now at Travis. He had been right in his guess at their deadliness, but he had only a fleeting chance to recognize that fact as the thing bore down, its whole attitude expressing the firm intention of goring him. He hurled his stone and then flung his body to one side, stumbling and rolling into the brush where he fought madly to regain his feet, expecting at any moment to feel trampling hoofs and thrusting horns. There was a crash to his right, and the bushes and grass were wildly shaken. On his hands and knees, the Apache retreated, his head turned to watch behind him. He saw the flirt of a triangular flap tail in the mouth of the cleft. The calf had escaped, and now the threshing in the bushes stilled. Was the thing stalking him? He got to his feet, for the first time hearing clearly the continued yapping, as if a battle was in progress. Then the second of the adult beasts came into view, backing and turning, trying to keep lowered head with menacing double horn always pointed to the coyotes, dancing a teasing, worrying circle about it. One of the coyotes flung up its head, looked upslope, and barked. Then, as one, both rushed the fighting beast, but for the first time from the same side, leaving it a clear path to retreat. It made a rush before, which they fled easily, and then it whirled with a speed and grace which did not fit its ungainly, ill-proportioned body, and jumped toward the cleft, the coyotes making no effort to hinder its escape. Travis came out of cover, approaching the brush which had concealed the crash of the other animal. The actions of the coyotes had convinced him that there was no danger now. They would never have allowed the escape of their prey had the first beast not been in difficulties. His shot with the stone, the Apache decided as he stood moments later surveying the twitching, crumpled body, must have hit the thing in the head, stunning it. Then the momentum of its charge had carried it full force against the rock to kill it. Blind luck, or the power of the Ga'un. He pulled back as the coyotes came padding up shoulder to shoulder to inspect the kill. It was truly more theirs than his. Their prey yielded not only food, but a weapon for Travis. Instead of the belt knife he had remembered having, he was now equipped with two. The double horn had been easy to free from the shattered skull, and some careful work with stones had broken off one prong at just the angle he wanted. So now he had a short and a longer tool, defense. At least they were better than the stone with which he had entered the hunt. Nalik-Ideyu pushed past him to lap daintily at the water. Then she sat up on her haunches, watching Travis as he smoothed the horn with a stone. "A knife," he said to her. "This will be a knife. And," he glanced up, measuring the value of the wood represented by the trees and bushes, "then a bow. With a bow we shall hunt better." The coyote yawned, her yellow eyes half closed, her whole pose one of satisfaction and contentment. "A knife," Travis repeated, "and a bow." He needed weapons. He had to have them. Why? His hand stopped scraping. Why? The toad-faced double horn had been quick to attack, but Travis could have avoided it, and it had not hunted him first. Why was he ridden by this fear that he must not be unarmed? He dipped his hand into the pool of the spring and lifted the water to cool his sweating face. The coyote moved, turned around in the grass, crushing down the growth into a nest in which she curled up, head on paws. But Travis sat back on his heels, his now idle hands hanging down between his knees, and forced himself to the task of sorting out jumbled memories. The landscape was wrong, totally unlike what it should be, but it was real. He had helped kill this alien creature. He had eaten its meat raw. Its horn lay within touch now. All that was real and unchangeable. Which meant that the rest of it, that other desert world in which he had wandered with his kind ridden horses, raided invading men of another race, that was not real, or else far, far removed from where he now sat. Yet there had been no dividing line between those two worlds. One moment he had been in the desert place, returning from a successful foray against the Mexicans. Mexicans. Travis caught at that identification, tried to use it as a thread to draw closer to the beginning of his mystery. Mexicans. And he was an Apache, one of the Eagle people, who had rode with Cochise. No. Sweat again beaded his face where the water had cooled it. He was not of that past. He was Travis Fox, of the very late 20th century, not a nomad of the middle 19th. He was of Team A of the project. The Arizona desert, and then this. From one to the other in an instant. He looked about him in rising fear. Wait. He had been in the dark when he got out of the desert, lying in a box. Getting out, he had crawled down a passage to reach moonlight. Strange moonlight. A box in which he had lain. A passage with smooth metallic walls and an alien world at the end of it. The coyote's ears twitched. Her head came up. She was staring at the man's drawn face, at his eyes with their core of fear. She whined. Travis caught up the two pieces of horn, thrust them into his sash belt, and got to his feet. Nalik Ideyu sat up, her head cocked a little to one side. As the man turned to seek his own back trail, she padded along in his wake and whined for Nagan Ulta. But Travis was more intent now on what he must prove to himself than he was on the actions of the two animals. It was a wandering trail, and now he did not question his skill in being able to follow it so unerringly. The sun was hot. Winged things buzzed from the bushes. Small scuttling things fled from him through the tall grass. Once, Nagan Ilta growled a warning which led them all to a detour, and Travis might not have picked up the proper trace again had not the coyote scout led him to it. "Who are you?" he asked once, and then guessed it would have been better said, "What are you?" These were not animals, or rather they were more than the animals he had always known. And one part of him, the part which remembered the desert rancherias where Cochise had ruled, said they were spirits. Yet that other part of him, Travis shook his head, accepting them now for what they were, welcome company in an alien place. The day wore on close to sunset, and still Travis followed that wandering trail. The need which drove him kept him going through the rough country of hills and ravines. Now the mist lifted above towering walls of mountains very near him, yet not the mountains of his memory. These were dull brown, with a forbidding look, like sun-dried skulls bearing teeth in warning against all comers. With great difficulty Travis topped a rise. Ahead, against the skyline, stood both coyotes. And as the man joined them, first one and then the other flung back its head and sounded the sobbing, shattering cry which had been a part of that other life. The Apache looked down. His puzzle was answered in part. The wreckage crumpled on the mountainside was identifiable. A spaceship. Cold fear gripped him, and his own head went back. From between his tight lips came a cry as desolate and despairing as the one the animals had voiced. End of chapter 3. Chapter 4 of The Defiant Agents by Andre Norton. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Defiant Agents. Chapter 4. Fire, mankind's oldest ally, weapon, tool, leapt high before the naked stone of the mountainside. Men sat cross-legged about it, 15 of them. And behind, guarded by the flames in that somber circle, were the women. There was a uniformity in this gathering. The members were plainly all of the same racial stock, of medium height, stocky, yet fine down to the peak of stamina and endurance, their skin brown, their shoulder-length hair black. And they were all young, none over 30, some still in their late teens. Alike, too, was a certain drawn look in their faces, a tenseness of the eyes and mouth as they listened to Travis. "So we must be on Topaz. Do any of you remember boarding the ship?" "No, only that we awoke within it." Across the fire one chin lifted. The eyes which caught Travis held a deep, smoldering anger. "This is more trickery of the Pindalik Oyi, the White Eyes. Between us there has never been fair dealing." They have broken their promise as a man breaks a rotten stick, for their words are as rotten. And it was you, Fox, who brought us to listen to them." A stir about the circle, a murmur from the women. "And do I not also sit here with you in this strange wilderness?" he countered. "I do not understand." Another of the men held out his hand, palm up, in a gesture of asking. "What has happened to us? We were in the old Apache world. I, Jill Lee, was riding with a Cuchillo Negro as we went down to the taking of Ramos. And then I was here, in a broken ship, and beside me a dead man who was once my brother. How did I come out of the past of our people into another world across the stars?" "Pinda lick o ye tricks," the first speaker spat into the fire. "It was the Redax, I think," Travis replied. "I heard Dr. Ashe discuss this. A new machine which could make a man remember not his own past, but the past of his ancestors. While we were on that ship, we must have been under its influence. So we lived as our people lived 100 years or more ago." "And the purpose of such a thing?" Jill Lee asked. "To make us more like our ancestors, perhaps. It is part of what they told us at the project. To venture into these new worlds requires a different type of man than lives on Terra today. Traits we have forgotten are needed to face the dangers of wild places." "You, Fox, have been beyond the stars before, and you found there were such dangers to face?" "It is true. You have heard of the three worlds I saw when the ship from the old days took us off, unwilling, to the stars. Did you not all volunteer to pioneer in this manner so you could see strange and new things?" "But we did not agree to be returned to the past in medicine dreams and be sent unknowingly into space." Travis nodded. "Deklay is right. But I know no more than you why we were so sent or why the ship crashed. We have found Dr. Ruthven's body in the cabin with that new installation. Only we have discovered nothing else which tells us why we were brought here. With the ship broken, we must stay." They were silent now, men and women alike. Behind them lay several days of activity, nights of exhausted slumber. Against the cliff wall lay the packs of supplies they had salvaged from the wreck. By mutual consent, they had left the vicinity of the broken globe, following their old custom of speedily withdrawing from a place of death. "This is a world empty of men?" Jill Lee wanted to know. "So far we have found only animal signs, and the Ga'an have not warned us of anything else." "Those devil ones!" Again Deklay spat into the fire. "I say we should have no dealings with them. The M'ba'a is no friend to the people." Again a murmur which seemed one of agreement answered that outburst. Travis stiffened. Just how much influence had the Redax had over them? He knew from his own experience that sometimes he had an odd double reaction, two different feelings which almost sickened him when they struck simultaneously. And he was beginning to suspect that with some of the others the return to the past had been far more deep and lasting. Now Jill Lee was actually to reason out what had happened. While Deklay had reverted to an ancestor who had ridden with Victorio or Magnus Colorado, Travis had a flash of premonition, a chill which made him half foresee a time when the past and the present might well split them apart, fatally. "Devil or Ga'an," a man with a quiet face, rather deeply sunken eyes, spoke for the first time. "We are in two minds because of this Redax, so let us not do anything in haste. Back in the desert world of the people I have seen the M'ba'a, and he was very clever. With the badger he went hunting, and when the badger had dug up the rat's nest, so did the M'ba'a wait on the other side of the thorny bush and watch those who would escape that way. Between him and the badger there was no war. These two who sit over yonder now, they are also hunters, and they seem friendly to us. In a strange place, a man needs all the help he can find. Let us not call names out of old tales which may mean nothing in fact.
Buck speaks straightly, Jill Lee agreed. We seek a camp which can be defended, for perhaps there are men here whose hunting territory we have invaded, though we have not yet seen them. We are a people small in number and alone. Let us walk softly on trails which are strange to our feet.
Inwardly, Travis sighed in relief. Buck, Jill Lee, for the moment their sensible words appeared to swing the opinions of the party. If either of them could be established as Halzeel or clan leader, they would all be safer. He himself had no aspirations in that direction and dared not push too hard. It had been his initial urging which had brought them as volunteers into the project. Now he was doubly suspect, and especially by those who thought as Deklay. He was considered too alien to their old ways. So far their protests had been fewer than he anticipated, although brothers and sisters had followed each other into the team after the immemorial desire of Apaches to cling to family ties. They were not a true clan with solidity of that to back them, but representatives of half a dozen. Basically, back on Terra, they had all been among the most progressive of their people, progressive, that is, in the white man's sense of the word. Travis had a fleeting recognition of his now oblique way of thinking. He, too, had been marked by the Redax. They had all been educated in the modern fashion, and all possessed a spirit of adventure which marked them over their fellows. They had volunteered for the team and successfully passed the tests to weed out the temperamentally unfit or faint-hearted. But all that was before Redax. Why had they been submitted to that? And why this flight? What had pushed Dr. Ashe and Murdoch and Colonel Calgary's, time agents he knew and trusted, into dispatching them without warning to Topaz? Something had happened, something which had given Dr. Ruthven ascendancy over those others, and had started them on this wild trip. Travis was conscious of a stir about the firelit circle. The men were rising, moving back into the shadows, stretching out on the blankets they had found among the other stores on the ship. They had discovered weapons there, knives, bows, quivers of arrows, all of which they had been trained to use in the intensive schooling of the project, and which needed no more repair than they themselves could give. And the rations they carried were field supplies, few of them. Tomorrow they must begin hunting in earnest.
Why has this thing been done to us?
Buck was beside Travis, those quiet eyes sliding past him to seek the fire once more.
I do not think you were told when the rest of us were not.
Travis seized upon that. There are those who say that I knew, agreed?
That is so. Once we stood at the same place in time, in our thoughts, our desires. Now we stand at many places, as if we climbed a stairway, each at his own speed. A stairway the Pinda Lig Oyi has set upon us. Some here, some there, some yet farther above. He sketched a series of step outlines in the air. And in this there is trouble.
The truth, Travis agreed. Yet it is also true that I knew nothing of this, that I climb with you on these stairs.
So I believe. But there comes a time when it is best not to be a woman stirring a pot of boiling stew, but rather one who stands quietly at a distance.
You mean? Travis pressed.
I say that alone among us, you have crossed the stars before. Therefore, new things are not so hard to understand. And we need a scout. Also, the coyotes run in your footsteps, and you do not fear them.
It made good sense. Let him scout ahead of the party, taking the coyotes with him. Stay away from the camp for a while and speak small, until the people on Buck's stairway were more closely united.
I go in the morning,
Travis agreed. He could slip away tonight, but just now he could not force himself away from the fire, from the companionship.
"You might take Zoe with you," Buck continued.
Travis waited for him to enlarge on that suggestion. Zoe was one of the youngest of their group, Buck's own cross-cousin and near brother.
"It is well," Buck explained, "that we learn this land, and it has always been our custom that the younger walk in the footprints of the older. Also, not only should trails be learned, but also men."
Travis caught the thought behind that. Perhaps by taking the younger men as scouts, one after another, he could build up among them a following of sorts. Among the Apaches, leadership was wholly a matter of personality. Until the reservation days, chieftains had gained their position by force of character alone, though they might come successively from one family clan over several generations. He did not want the chieftainship here. No, but neither did he want growing whispers working about him to cut him off from his people. To every Apache, severance from the clan was a little death. He must have those who would back him if Deklay, or those who thought like Deklay, turned grumbling into open hostility.
"Tsoe is one quick to learn," Travis agreed. "We go at dawn."
"Along the mountain range?" Buck inquired.
"If we seek a protected place for the rancheria, yes. The mountains have always provided good strongholds for the people."
"And do you think there is need for a fort?"
Travis shrugged. "I have been one day's journey out into this world. I saw nothing but animals. But that is no promise that elsewhere there are no enemies. The planet was on the tapes we brought back from that other world, and so it was known to the others, who once rode between star and star, as we rode between ranch and town. If they had this world set on a journey tape, it was for a reason. That reason may still be in force."
"Yet it was long ago that these star people rode so," Buck mused. "Would the reason last so long?"
Travis remembered two other worlds, one of weird desert inhabited by beast-things, or had they once been human, human to the point of possessing intelligence, that had come out of sand burrows at night to attack a spaceship, and the second world where the ruins of a giant city had stood choked with jungle vegetation, where he had made a blowgun from tubes of rustless metal as a weapon gift for small winged men. But were they men? Both had been remnants of that ancient galactic empire.
"Some things could so remain," he answered soberly. "If we find them, we must be careful. But first, a good site for the rancheria."
"There is no return to home for us," Buck stated flatly.
"Why do you say that? There could be a rescue ship later."
The other raised his eyes again to Travis.
"When you slept under the redax, how did you ride?"
"As a warrior, raiding, living."
"And I was one with Go'ndi," Buck returned simply.
But the white man has assured us that such power, the power of a chief, does not exist?"
"Yes, the Pindalik-Oyi has told us so many things. He is busy. Busy with his tools, his machines, always busy. And those who think in another fashion cannot be measured by his rules, so they are foolish dreamers. Not all white men think so. There was Dr. Ashe. He was beginning to understand a little. Perhaps I too am standing still, halfway up the stairway of the past. But of this I am very sure. For us, there will be no return to our own place, and the time will come when something new shall grow from the seed of the past. Also, it is necessary that you be one of the tenders of that growth. So I urge you, take Tsoe and the next time Lupe. For the young, who may be swayed this way and that way by words,
as the wind shakes a small tree, must be given firm roots. In Travis, education warred with instinct, just as the picture Redax had planted in his mind had warred with his awaking to this alien landscape. Yet now he believed he must be guided by what he felt, and he knew that no man of his race would claim Go'ndi, the power of spirit known only to a great chief, unless he had actually felt it swell within him. It might have been fostered by hallucination in the past, but the aura of it carried into the here and now, and Travis had no doubts that Buck believed implicitly in what he said, and that belief carried credulity to others. "This is wisdom, Nantan." Buck shook his head. "I am no Nantan, no chief, but of some things I am sure. You also be sure of what lies within you, younger brother." On the third day, ranging eastward along the base of the mountain range, Travis found what he believed would be an acceptable campsite. There was a canyon with a good spring of water cut round by well-marked game trails. A series of ledges brought him up to a small plateau where scrub wood could be used to build the wickiups. Water and food lay within each, and the ledge approach was easy to defend. Even Deklay and his fellow malcontents were forced to concede the value of the site. His duty to the clan accomplished, Travis returned to his own concern, one which had haunted him for days. Topaz had been taped by men of the vanished Star Empire. Therefore the planet was important, but why? As yet, he had found no indication that anything above the intelligence level of the Splithorns was native to this world. Yet he was gnawed by the certainty that there was something here, waiting, and the desire to learn what it was became an ever-burning ache. Perhaps he was what Deklay had accused him of being, one who had come to follow the road of the Pindalik-Oyi too closely. For Travis was content to scout with only the coyotes for company, and he did not find the loneliness of the unknown planet as intimidating as most of the others. He was checking his small trail pack on the fourth day, after they had settled on the plateau, when Buck and Jill Lee hunkered down beside him. "You go hunt?" Buck broke the silence first. "Not for meat." "What do you fear? That Ndendai, enemy people, have marked this as their land?" Jill Lee questioned. "That may be true, but now I hunt for what this world was at one time, the reason why the ancient Starmen marked it as their own." "And this knowledge may be of value to us?" Jill Lee asked slowly. "Will it bring food to our mouths, shelter for our bodies, mean life for us?" "All that is possible. It is the unknowing which is bad." "True, unknowing is always bad," Buck agreed. "But the bow which is fitted to one hand and strength of arm may not be suited to another. Remember that, younger brother. Also, do you go alone?" "With Nagan-Ulta and Nalik-Ideyu I am not alone." "Take Tsoe with you also. The four-footed ones are indeed gotten for the service of those they like, but it is not good that a man walks alone from his kind." There it was again, the feeling of clan solidarity which Travis did not always share. On the other hand, Tsoe would not be a hindrance. On other scouts, the boy had proved to have a keen eye for the country, and a liking for experimentation which was not a universal attribute even among those of his own age. "I would go to find a path through the mountains. It may be a long trail," Travis half protested. "You believe what you seek may lie to the north?" Travis shrugged. "I do not know. How can I? But it will be another way of seeking." "Tsoe shall go. He keeps silent before older warriors, and is proper for the untried. But his thoughts fly free, as do yours," Buck replied. "It is in him also," this need to see new places.
There is this. Jill Lee got to his feet. Do not go so far, brother, that you may not easily find a way to return. This is a wide land, and within it we are but a handful of men alone.
That, too, I know.
Travis thought he could read more than one kind of warning in Jill Lee's words.
They were the second day away from the plateau camp and climbing, when they chanced upon the pass Travis had hoped might exist. Before them lay an abrupt descent to what appeared to be open plains country cloaked in a dusky amber Travis now knew was the thick grass found in the southern valleys.
Tsoe pointed with his chin.
Wide land, good for horses, cattle, ranches.
But all those lay far beyond the black space surrounding them. Travis wondered if there was any native animal which could serve man in place of the horse.
"Do we go down?" Tsoe asked.
From this point Travis could sight no break far out on the amber plain, no sign of any building or any disturbance of its smooth emptiness. Yet it drew him.
"We go," he decided.
Close as it had looked from the pass, the plain was yet a day and a night, spent in careful watching by turns, ahead of them. It was mid-morning of the second day that they left the foothill breaks, and the grass of the open country was waist-high about them. Travis could see it rippling where the coyotes threaded ahead. Then he was conscious of a persistent buzzing, a noise which irritated faintly until he was compelled to trace it to its source. The grass had been trampled flat for an irregular patch, with a trail of broken stalks out of the heart of the plain. At one side was a buzzing, seething mass of glitter-winged insects, which Travis already knew as carrion-eaters. They arose reluctantly from their feast as he approached. He drew a short breath, which was close to a grunt of astounded recognition. What lay there was so impossible that he could not believe the evidence of his eyes. Tsoe gave a sharp exclamation, went down on one knee for a closer examination, then looked at Travis over his shoulder, his eyes wide, more than a trace of excitement in his voice.
"Horse dung! And fresh!"
End of Chapter 4.
When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at remarkable.com today.